appreciate her unique differences. Takeaway tips. Let's end this section with a few suggestions to deal successfully with the oppositeness rules problem. Reserve your dating life for people actively involved in the growth process. Those who are taking ownership of their deficits are less likely to develop dependencies on the strengths of others. Be in the growth process yourself. Growth attracts growth. You will find yourself more drawn to others for healthy reasons and less attracted to others because of what you don't possess. Make a distinction between attraction to a person based on your deficits or someone's attraction to you based on his deficits and attraction to a person's uniqueness and differentness. Make sure your dating relationship involves both love and truth. Challenge each other to grow. If your relationship is one of total comfort, you may be contributing to each other's spiritual laziness. Set boundaries on your tendencies to rescue each other from your character deficits. If you are the connector, like Pete, don't do all the relational work for your date. If you are the assertive one, like Alex, don't enable your date by doing all the confronting. Encourage, but don't rescue. Normalize and identify each of your character deficits. Such issues as detachment, irresponsibility, over-responsibility, perfectionism, authority conflicts, and the like should be topics that you both can talk about personally, about yourself and each other. Two good sources of information about these issues are the books Changes That Heal by Dr. Cloud and Hiding From Love by Dr. Townsend. Be agents of growth, healing, and change for each other, specifically in these issues. Part 3. Solving Dating Problems. When You're Part of the Problem. Chapter 10. Adapt Now, Pay Later. To put it mildly, Carrie was starstruck. She had a feeling when she met Steve that he was different. Handsome, successful, spiritual, loves kids, could have been his personal ad. He was everything that she had been looking for, and she could not believe that God had brought him into her life. She was floating on clouds. When they went on their first date, she liked how he took control. He had the evening completely planned out and seemed to take care of every detail. He gave her such a secure feeling just to be around someone who was so in charge. As the evening went on, she could tell that this was not just another someone, but the kind of person that she wanted to get to know better. That night when he dropped her off, she felt tingly inside. It surprised her when he called the next morning. "I had a great time last night. Let's do it again this afternoon," he said. There was that in-charge thing again, and she liked it just as much the next day as the first night. "Sure. What do you want to do?" she asked. "I have some tickets to the game, and we could do dinner afterwards. Pick you up at noon," Steve told her. Hesitating a bit, Carrie nevertheless said, "I'll be ready." She hung up the phone, surprised at how quickly she had said yes, for she knew that she had plans for dinner with some friends. But how could she refuse? She did not want to give him the wrong signal, that she was not interested. Besides, her friends would understand. After all, they would probably go out and talk about how difficult it had been lately to find quality guys, and she thought it would make a lot more sense to go out with one than to talk about it. So she called and let them know. When Steve picked her up, they seemed to click all over again. They had a great afternoon, and then were on their way to dinner when he asked, "How about Chinese food? I know a great place near here." "Sounds great," Carrie said. Inside, she cringed. She hated Chinese food with a passion, kidded her friends when they ate it, and had all sorts of derogatory names for it. But, after all, she did not want to argue about something so small. Nor did she want to ruin the evening when, after dinner, Steve suggested that they go for a walk around the lake. Dead tired and with an early appointment the next morning, Carrie agreed. She dared not say no. Little did Carrie know that this was a foreshadowing of what was to come. Over time, she began to notice that every time Steve suggested something, she complied. She was jelly in his hands. Falling in love day by day, she was interested only in being with him, and whatever he liked or wanted to do was fine as long as they were together. But after about 2 months, there was a gnawing in her stomach that was beginning to bother her. In the very beginning of the relationship, and some of this is normal, she had not cared about little things such as time constraints, other commitments, having different preferences, and things that might cause conflict. It mattered so much to her to not chase Steve away or be difficult for him that she just would comply. But it was beginning to not work for her, as she had other things to do and some of her own preferences that were not finding room in their decision-making. It began with her work. A freelance writer, she was getting behind in her work as she spent more and more time with him. So, slowly, she began to say that she had to go write or go research a story. It was the same with her friends. Gradually, she was missing them and began to want to spend time with them. So, she started to say no to some of Steve's requests. In addition, she was beginning to want to do other things than the ones that he would suggest. At first, he was fine with her working. But before long, he began to get upset with her when she would make choices that would take her away from him or that were different than he wanted. He would get irritated and short with her, and sometimes she felt like he was not very mature. Finally, things came to a head when she had to go on a trip to cover a story for a magazine, and he did not want her to go. "This just does not work for me," he told her. "You have to make a choice. It's either going to be your work or me. I cannot come behind your work all the time." And then he drove off. Carrie was heartbroken and quick to blame herself. She saw her friend Sandy and told her what had happened and was full of confessions. "He's right. I just can't expect to have my own career and keep someone happy at the same time. I'll have to find another way to work. I just hope I've not lost him." But as Sandy listened to the story and had witnessed some of it over recent months, she was seeing a pattern. As long as Carrie had been adaptive to Steve and his wishes and wants, things went smoothly. But as soon as she had begun to be a real person with needs and desires of her own, he was unable to deal with the equality. It was his way or the highway. Sandy was honest with her friend, something that was risky. She knew how much Carrie was attached to Steve, but she loved Carrie and had to tell her the truth. Sandy told Carrie that she had not been herself with Steve. In fact, Carrie was no longer the person that Sandy knew and respected. Sandy said, "You're wrong in thinking that you can't have your career and have a relationship too. After all, you have to work. Steve liked you, but only when you were doing what he liked. Has he ever adapted himself to what you'd like? I think that you need to stand your ground and find out what kind of person he really is." The truth was hard for Carrie to hear, but she stood her ground with her friend's support, and Steve did not like it. When she told him that there were going to be times that she would have to work and that she might not be there as much as she had been in the beginning, he could not take it. He said that it proved that she did not really care about him and their relationship, and that they did not want the same things after all. Carrie was devastated at first, but through the help of friends like Sandy, she realized that she had avoided a train wreck. Better to find out in the early months of a relationship that you're with someone who cannot adapt to your wishes than to find out much later, or, God forbid, after marriage. She was grateful, and she had learned a lesson. Don't be someone you are not just to gain someone's love. If you do, the person that your loved one is loving is not you. It's the role that you are playing, and not your true self who is being loved. Wishes, needs, and desires. As Carrie discovered, you cannot act forever. As one of my counselees said one day about his relationship with his wife, "At some point I always screw up and have an opinion." It just happens. You are a person, and you cannot go throughout life without pursuing your own wishes, needs, and desires, nor should you. Your needs and desires are going to come out, and you had better find out early in the relationship where the person you're dating really stands with the idea of sometimes having to adapt to them. Otherwise, you'll be in the situation that Carrie found herself in. She adapted early and gave Steve a false idea of who she was. Then, as she began to be who she really was, there was a problem. He thought he was getting a really compliant woman who would do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. And she was adding to that illusion by her behavior. When the truth came out, there was trouble. Sometimes the truth takes years to come out, but it always happens, and it is never pretty. Take it from us. As marriage counselors, we see many, many marriages that get into trouble with this dynamic. One person has very poor boundaries when the relationship begins, and the other has all the control. Then, after some amount of time in the marriage, the compliant one cannot take it anymore. He or she finally stands up and wants to be a person. And many times the spouse, who is more often than not self-centered, does not like it. The rules are changing, and the spouse does not have the tools to deal with the change, and the marriage gets into trouble. Sometimes it grows, sometimes it adapts, and sometimes it does not. The key to remember is that the only reason that a marriage like that exists in the first place and has gone on like that is that one person adapted from the beginning. If that person had had boundaries, like Carrie found, the marriage never would have happened. Or if it did, the problem would have been fixed first. Make sure that you do not end up in a relationship that turns into a bad marriage. You don't want to be telling some counselor the following things 10 years from now. She seems to have her way. I'm afraid to let my real feelings and desires be known. We have so much conflict over such little things. We always spend our money on what he wants. She doesn't care about me and what I want. Why can't he ever go to the places that I want to go to? Issues like these are usually discovered later in a relationship where one partner has adapted for a long time and then makes a change. The lesson of this chapter is to be yourself from the beginning, and then you can find someone who is authentic as well. A relationship like that has mutuality and partnership. It has give and take. It has equality. It has sharing and mutual self-sacrifice for the sake of the other and the relationship. If you're a real person from the start, a relationship of mutuality has a chance of developing. If you're not, then you might be headed for trouble. Bad attractions. The question of many singles is, why do I keep attracting such jerks? They think that something is inherently wrong with them, and sometimes they can begin to get quite hopeless over their chances of finding someone good to date or marry. People who are selfish and controlling can only be that way if they are in relationship with someone who is adaptive. If someone stands up to them and is honest about his or her wants and desires, then the controlling person has to learn to share or gets frustrated and goes away. The little things in life are where you can spot the big things. If you're with a self-centered person who cannot give to your desires, you will find out soon enough by being honest and straightforward about simple things, for that is where day-to-day life is lived. You will quickly find out if you're with someone who is able to share or someone who has to have his or her way all the time. This knowledge will be helpful now and essential for the future. Takeaway tips. Tell the truth about where you want to go and not go, or what you want to do or not do. Be honest about your preferences and desires. Don't act like you like things that your date likes just so that you'll be accepted. Being liked for who you are requires that you be that person. Don't be afraid to share your desires and wants for fear of conflict. Find out early if you are with someone who can share equally. Get feedback from honest friends to tell you if you're really being yourself and seeing the relationship realistically. Remember, with each decision that you make, You are giving the other person an impression of what you like in life and in a relationship. Be careful. He or she might believe you. When you give or serve, let it be honest and purposeful. Chapter 11. Too much, too fast. One of my, Dr. Townsend's, closest friends, Chuck, is a talented songwriter. When we were college buddies, I was visiting him in his room one day. Chuck picked up his guitar and said, "Want to hear my new love song?" I said I did, and he sang me the following: "I love you, always have, always will. What's your name?" I never found out whether Chuck was referring to his dating history or simply observing college romantic life, but I knew I could identify with his lyrics. I understood the ritual of intense professions of undying love, followed by the realization of utter ignorance about one's beloved. In other words, too much, too fast. The problem of premature commitment and over-involvement in a dating relationship is a common one. Two people find that they have strong feelings for each other. In a short period of time, they begin investing enormous amounts of time in the relationship. They suspend or neglect other people, interests, and activities. They quickly start dating exclusively. They feel intense passion for each other and miss each other deeply when they're apart. They may marry soon thereafter, or they may break up, only to repeat the fast pace with someone else. Either way the relationship resolves itself, the couple is typified by a drivenness to become highly committed, a process that takes less than a normal amount of time. What is normal? While the Bible is not explicit on the issue of how long a dating relationship should go on, we would suggest that a year, not including the engagement period, is a good minimum. We wouldn't consider 2 or 3 years unrealistic. We know that God has set up a time and a season for every activity under heaven, Ecclesiastes 3:1. When you date for at least a year, you experience a good measure of the seasons of life that people go through: holidays, fiscal periods, vacations, school terms, etc. You can observe how the relationship deals with the flow of life of both people. This information is invaluable in helping a couple see what kind of a fit they are. Yet many people meet, date, and mate within a few months, or even weeks. They believe they have recognized the right person and think they're ready for marriage. Or some couples will take the requisite year or two to date, but will have a problem in front-loading the relationship. They become deeply committed very soon in the game and never go through a process of gradually becoming closer over time. Either way, the issue is the same. For a number of reasons that we will show, the couple sees time as the adversary and actively resists any more of it than is necessary. Why wait? Youth specialist Josh McDowell asked that question to millions of teens about saving sex for marriage. The same question applies to the issue of pacing how quickly to get involved in your dating relationship. Why should you wait, take time, and become closer in a gradual manner to a person to whom you are enormously attracted? Here are some helpful answers to that question. Relationships do not tolerate shortcuts. First, we have to understand the nature of relationships as God designed them. This applies not only to dating, but families and friendships. Relationships grow in a healthy manner only as they undergo experiences, and there is no shortcut to experiences. In other words, we only know each other to the extent that we have experience with each other. We can know facts about the person we're dating, their friends, job, hobbies, and so forth. But that doesn't mean we know them as a person. That kind of knowing cannot come from reading a file on someone. For example, when Adam knew Eve, Genesis 4:1 in King James language, he was knowing her in experience, in the deep intimacy that comes in healthy sexuality. Experience requires time. It's simply impossible to get enough experiences under your belt without spending a lot of time dealing with the relationship. Here are some examples of necessary time-consuming dating activities on the road to become committed to someone. Having enough talks to safely open up with each other. Entering each other's worlds of work, hobbies, worship, and service. Meeting and spending time with each other's friends. Understanding each other's strengths and weaknesses. Going over basic values of what's important in life to each other. Getting to know each other's families. Spending time away from each other to think through the relationship, alone and with friends. Learning your best style of disagreement and conflict management. It's hard to imagine doing all that in a few months, because it can't be done. Yet so many dreamy-eyed couples will say to their friends, "You don't understand. It's as if we've known each other all our lives. We were soulmates from the first meeting." And while I know people who have met and married quickly, I think their success is due more to their own character than to going through the process the right way. For example, my Aunt Johnny and Uncle Walton have been married over 50 years. I've seen his framed proposal of marriage to her. He wrote it to her when they were both in kindergarten. I guess they both knew each other was the one pretty early on in life. But I don't think they would attribute their successful marriage to how early they committed. Knowing and observing them all my life, I think they would instead talk about love, the right values, their faith, and being able to go through good times and bad together. There is no microwave dating that makes any sense. Go through the seasons of life with the person you believe might be the one God has meant for you. A measure of importance. Secondly, the time involved in dating someone should reflect the significance of the relationship. Simply put, the more important a decision is, the more time it should take to make it. This sounds obvious, but many couples miss the mark here. We spend many years deciding on a career. We wrestle for long periods over committing to our faith. We research financial dealings for months. It makes sense that our most important human relationship should also warrant the time due it. So many married couples look back on their dating lives and regret that they did not take more time to evaluate, question, explore, and challenge issues with each other. When you're dating, it's hard sometimes to think beyond the warm, deep, and romantic feelings the relationship may elicit. But few decisions in life are more profoundly life-changing than marriage. Look at some of the significant aspects of marriage. A lifelong commitment to loving one person only. Forsaking all other opportunities for romantic love other than that person. Being in relationship with all the bad, immature, and broken parts of that person. Having your own bad, immature, and broken parts open to the scrutiny of that person. Solving conflict in ways that do not involve leaving the relationship. Staying in the relationship even if the other person changes for the worse. Being called to sacrifice many individual preferences for the sake of the relationship. This list isn't meant to depress you, but to help you see the gravity of what dating is meant to produce. To make a hasty, impassioned, or reactive decision can be disastrous. All things being equal, a bad marriage is probably more painful than a bad single state. Why? Because in a bad marriage, the structure of intimacy is in place, but it does not have the heart of intimacy. Two people live their lives together, intertwined by being in the same house, sleeping in the same bed, and raising the same children, yet emotionally they live alone. Living alone within the marriage contract makes the disconnection feelings so acute that many people leave the marriage. With such serious factors at stake, it's worth it to take ample time to get to know someone. The nature of love. Another reason to take your time is that this is a necessary part of learning how to love. Dating should not only produce a mate, it should also develop within you the ability to love that mate deeply and well. Love, as the Bible defines it, is a stance of working for the best for another person. God's love moved him to send his Son for our best, John 3:16. When we learn how to date the right way, that sort of love is born and grows within us. For example, when you pace your relationship, you're giving up things you would like now for a greater benefit later. You are tolerating delay of gratification, experiencing frustration, and learning patience. You are learning to care for a person who does not belong to you yet, which is an anxiety-provoking situation. Basically, taking time in your dating relationship helps you clarify the distinction between need and love. Both are about seeking relationship, and both are good aspects of life, but they are often confused. Need seeks closeness to fill up our deficits, such as loneliness, dependency, or powerlessness. Love seeks closeness for its own sake, knowing that the other person benefits from the relationship. If you're dating someone who is pressing you to commit earlier than you would like, ask him why he wants to. Unless you are a total commitment-phobic person, most of his reasons will probably involve some need he has, such as needing the security of knowing he has your total commitment, wanting to end the sexual frustration, needing the relationship in order to feel complete, needing someone to relate to in his life. These desires may involve good needs, but they are no reason for speeding up things. They all involve some sort of dependency and put you in a parental role at some level. As we will see many times in this book, one of the worst things you can do is try to re-parent someone you are dating. It usually causes confusion and pain for both parties. Remember to use gradual, well-paced dating to not only seek love, but also to become loving. Love is patient. 1 Corinthians 13:4. Am I going too fast? It can be difficult to tell if you're going too fast. Love does have an individual pace for people. Some can safely progress more quickly than others. They may be better decision makers or be more mature in relationships than others. Also, there is such a thing as going too slow. Consider the plight of the woman who has dated a commitment-phobic guy for years with no hope of progress. Here are some ways of determining if you are committing too quickly. You know each other emotionally more than you know each other objectively. You find yourself more invested in the relationship than in areas of your life that are important to you. You abruptly stop dating others. You get feedback from friends that this seems to be going quickly. Whatever the signs, pay attention to them. As a rule of thumb, it's better to err on the side of caution. Why we don't wait. If there are such benefits to dating at a gradual pace, then why do we see so much over-involvement? There are lots of reasons people dive into the shallow end of love. Here are some of the main ones. Loneliness. Loneliness is one of the most painful yet necessary experiences in life. People feel incomplete, empty, or even starving inside. It is also a strong motivating force, just as food hunger is. Loneliness can make us do almost anything to fill up the hole inside. It is easy to see how, when you find someone you're drawn to, you can quickly fill your life up with that person. Loneliness is stronger than resolve, willpower, or discipline. People will promise themselves not to get too involved and find that their promise melts when their relational hunger meets a person they desire. All of a sudden, they're spending every evening together and settling into a pattern of being a couple. Loneliness is not the enemy here, however. When we're lonely, it's a signal that we are alive. God created us with a drive to connect and be attached to Himself and others. It's a good thing, because loneliness ultimately leads us to relationship, and that is where God wants all of us. We are all members of one body, Ephesians 4:25. Relationship cures loneliness. However, dating is not the kind of relationship that cures loneliness. And that is the real problem here. Relationships that resolve loneliness must have certain elements, such as safety, unconditional love, and deep commitment. These elements help the person take in the love they need, get connected to life, and stay in relationship. Dating does not have those elements. At least, at first, it's exploratory and low commitment in nature. So, lonely people often get deeply and quickly connected to someone. Then, when conflicts arise, they're devastated because they invested such deep parts of their hearts and souls in the relationship. If you're getting too close too soon out of loneliness, use it as a signal to get connected with some good, solid, non-dating relationships. Deal with loneliness before it backfires on you. Difficulty in leaving home. Some couples will appear almost married at early stages of the courtship. They will rapidly establish themselves as a unit, with their own patterns and predictable schedule. They may seem settled and secure with each other. In some ways, it might look like a picture of what most people dream about, the lifetime soulmate. However, there may be a darker nature to the picture. Sometimes a couple seems to couple very quickly because they have not finished the task of emotionally leaving home. They're unable to navigate single life and find that it's not working well for them. Thus, they are opting more for the marriage state than they are for the person. One of the descriptions of an adult is a person who has effectively left home. It has to do with moving out of dependency on one's family and becoming autonomous and responsible for oneself. Everyone needs a transition period in early adulthood in which they gradually take what they have gleaned from home and create a life for themselves away from home. This is why the college and early 20s years are so important. They provide a context to learn how to live life on one's own. Leaving home applies not only to the doing areas of life, such as finances, career decisions, and home building, but also the relating areas of life. Adults move out of emotional dependency on their family. They love them, but they no longer need them as they used to. This prepares them for the leaving and cleaving process, Genesis 2:24, that God has designed for us. We move away from the family of origin and create our own family in friendships, work, church, and neighborhoods. Singleness is a struggle for those who have not finished leaving home. They do not enjoy it and may feel it as an empty, cold, or unsafe way to live. They're still at some level yearning for the home environment that they never finished leaving, and that's why they often commit so quickly. Marriage is the only way they can experience being home. This becomes a problem when, after they have married, the dependencies surface in other ways. For example, one person becomes totally dependent on another, or one still prefers mom and dad over her spouse, or one is now wanting more freedom from his spouse as he is now ready to leave home. This struggle applies not only to never-marrieds, but also to divorced folks. Many divorced people will overcommit because they're more used to the married state. As one previously married woman told me, "I married my ex-husband when I was 19, and we were married 30 years. I don't know the rules of singleness." In this problem, it's often good to separate out the person from the lifestyle. Difficulties in sustaining friendships. Some people will overcommit due to problems in making deep, sustaining friendships. They will find that they don't feel a part of life and can't get truly close to people. It may be hard for them to trust others. They struggle with what are called attachment issues. People with attachment issues may not feel lonely. In fact, they may feel relief when they are alone, as their need for relationship has been cut off. I have a friend who is one of the most talented drawing artists I have ever met. He draws breathtaking scenes, yet he couldn't talk to anyone about anything but art. Intimacy was an area he had little experience in. Then, at 19, he met a girl who was highly relational and outgoing. He fell quickly in love with her, and they became inseparable, marrying in a few months. I asked him what attracted him to her, and he said, "She makes it easy to talk and relate. It's hard with others." I can appreciate that, but I also have seen, over the years, her resentment at being the only conduit to life that her husband has. Perfectionism. You would think that perfectionists would never marry, being too picky. They would be fearful of making a mistake, or forever worried they had committed to someone who was okay, then encounter the perfect person around the corner. Yes, sometimes a perfectionist will delay commitment. But being driven by ideals can also cause the opposite problem of committing too quickly. This is because people deal with their perfectionism in different ways. For example, some perfectionists become quickly committed to a person who seems to represent every weakness they don't have. Their friends will scratch their heads in bewilderment and try to adapt to someone that none of them have anything in common with. This is often because the perfectionist, being unable to resolve her own weaknesses, badness, and imperfections, will instead quickly fall in love with someone who possesses them. She projects what she is unable to tolerate in herself onto her beloved. In this way, she is still in relationship with all of the parts of herself, yet she doesn't have to take ownership of them. When you see the angel woman quickly committing to devilish guys, this is one of the likely causes. What is not worked on in our souls is often found in those we choose. What should I do? If your dating life tends to be too much, too fast, there are several things you can do about it. They are not enjoyable and involve some work. But if you are tired of the roller coaster of intense but failed relationships, it's worth it. Identify what is driving the pace. It could be loneliness, fear of being out in the world, problems in making friends, or perfectionism. Work on these issues as life issues, not as dating problems. As you mature in these areas, the frenzy will often resolve itself. Get a life. A full life is probably the best antidote for getting too close too fast. Nature abhors a vacuum, and people tend to fill up emptiness with romantic commitment. Ask God to help you get involved in real life, spending time on friends, work, hobbies, church, service, and God Himself. Deliberately slow the pace to diagnose the relationship. If you can slow your pace, you will quickly find out what is underneath the speedy commitment. For example, the other person may become frustrated and impatient, as he doesn't want to deal with the problems between you. Or you may find anxious, sad, or angry feelings welling up that the fast pace has protected you from. If the relationship is mature, it will withstand the test of slowing down. Investigate who is contributing to the pace. Does it tend to be you, those you date, or both? This helps you find out where the pressure is coming from and do something about it. Ask friends for feedback. Humbly go to mature, safe friends and ask them to tell you when you're getting weird. When they see that crazed look in your eye and you're preparing to heavily invest in someone quickly, give them permission to say stop. It's easy to get overcommitted quickly in the world of dating. However, resolving what is driving that pace can provide a more balanced and healthy dating life. Takeaway tips. If the relationship is moving quickly, look at that as a signal and ask yourself why. Avoid the tendency toward too quick involvement by getting involved with each other's real lives, especially friendships. Deal with conflicts, differences, and preferences instead of glossing them over. Remember that quick, intense relationships often end up either burning out or being shallow. Real love takes time and has no shortcut, but it's worth it. Make sure you're not moving quickly because you're avoiding some other pain, such as loneliness or inner hurt. Ask God to make you patient with the process of love and to be able to experience its growth day by day. Chapter 12. Don't Get Kidnapped. Debbie was getting to a pretty good place in her growth. She had been working on some issues in her life and had been very successful with the support system that she had developed. Having struggled with a few difficult relationships and some self-image problems, she was happy to be getting to a new place in her life. She had not dated anyone seriously since she and her fiancé had had a tough breakup a year before. It was at that time that she turned to her friends for healing and stability. And it had paid off. Debbie was having a good time with her friends and feeling good about life and the future. She had gotten active in her spiritual life and church, as well as pursuing some new hobbies and interests. She had learned to sail and was taking some art classes. Most of her social life was spent dating different people and hanging out with her friends. And she was really beginning to find fulfillment in some community projects that she had volunteered for. Life was getting good again. Then she met Nick. They hit it off right away and began spending a lot of time together. Soon they were dating exclusively. At first, her friends were excited for her that she had found someone that she liked so much. They kidded her about being lost at sea and other metaphors for not seeing her very much. It seemed that Nick was becoming her whole life. But for her, her new relationship with Nick seemed like the next step in her life becoming everything she had wanted. But as time went on, her friends weren't laughing anymore. They were sad because they rarely saw Debbie. They would occasionally talk to her on the phone, but it seemed that she was always on her way out to do something with Nick, or was at his house, or something like that. They were excited for her, but they missed her as well. Finally, they just settled into the fact that she was in love and they had seen the last of her for a while. They were also unhappy because they were really not getting to know him either. On a few occasions they had met him, but they never really did things with Nick and Debbie. The group activities that all of them had done for so long were not happening anymore, so Nick was somewhat of a mystery to Debbie's circle of friends. Meanwhile, from Debbie's perspective, everything was wonderful. They loved doing things together and were enjoying getting to know each other better. Debbie knew that she was falling in love. What she did not see was that she was gradually changing, or being changed. Once strongly interested in so many outside activities and hobbies, she mostly just hung out with Nick and did whatever he wanted to do. He was an avid surfer, and she would spend a lot of her time at the beach, watching and reading. The community work that she had spent a lot of time investing in was not getting any of her attention anymore, nor was her group, who had been such a big part of her growth. But she was so happy that she did not really miss any of it. Spiritually, it seemed that all her interest in God had gone away. It wasn't that she had turned her back on him, she was simply consumed with Nick. She found herself thinking little about God or spiritual growth anymore. But she was so happy. Things continued like this until two things happened that served as a wake-up call for Debbie. First, she began sleeping with Nick, something that she had vowed not to do again until she was safely married. Her vow was part of her spiritual commitment to God, and also wisdom she had learned from her previous breakup. What had looked like it would be forever had not been after all, and she felt devastated that she had given herself away to someone who had ultimately used her. Now she found herself doing the same thing again, although this time she had assured herself was really going to be forever. But as time went on, her duplicity was beginning to gnaw at her, and she also didn't like how casually Nick was taking their sex life. In the beginning, he had seemed so spiritually committed, but as she was finding out, his spirituality did not have very deep roots. The second wake-up call was one day when Nick asked her if she would be interested in looking into cosmetic surgery. At first, she thought he was kidding, but when she laughed it off, he did not, and pursued it further. "I just think it would help your overall looks," he said. Debbie was devastated, but more than that, she began thinking. She began to remember other conversations that she and Nick had had about her. Some were about her looks, her hair, at times her weight. She was a very normal and attractive weight. Others were about her wardrobe and style, and as she thought more about it, others were about significant areas of her life. She remembered his criticism of sailing when she first shared her excitement about her new passion. He thought it was boring and not where the real action was. That's how he ended up surfing a lot with her watching. Surfing was not boring, according to Nick. But as she really began to think about it, watching surfing was not that exciting either. She had just been so happy to be near Nick that she had lost touch with her interests. There were other subtle criticisms as well about her other interests. He was not mean at all about them, which is probably why she did not notice that it was happening. It was more of a combination of thinking that things she liked and wanted were not really that great, or more often, he just had a better way of doing things or better things to do. The same thing had been true about her friends. He had not really clicked with them that much, and that was part of why she had gotten so separated from them. He would say things about her friends like, "She's a little too artsy for me," or other comments that were not really put-downs, but enough to show that he was not interested in the people that she loved. But again, she had missed it because being with him was what mattered to her. She just felt so good to be with him that pushing him into things or people that he did not like was not a priority to her. She loved being with him, and this was the subtlety. He was great to be around. He was fun, positive, pleasant, and so much more. So it was not as if he had been mean and critical. He just had subtly negated most of the people and things that were important to her. She was beginning to see that now. Nick was a strong personality, which was part of what she loved about him. But that strength was not directed in pursuing her life and desires as much as his own. As a result, she saw that she had lost touch with her values as well as a lot of the things that she loved. It was surprising to her how much she had given in to his loving control. The rest of Debbie's story was not easy, but fortunately had a good ending. Thanks to the cosmetic surgery comment, she went to talk to a few of her friends. She opened up about the physical comments and cosmetic surgery suggestion, as well as the way that she had lost touch with a lot of her hobbies and other things that were important to her. She told them that she was sleeping with Nick as well. The friends had all covenanted with each other to be available for support to one another in that area if it were needed. Debbie was sad that she had not taken advantage of her friend's support earlier. But now it was there, and she was seeing the need for their help in seeing reality. At that point, they did what friends are supposed to do. They were very direct and enraged. It is interesting sometimes to see how the people who love someone often expresses the anger that the person is unable to express themselves. "What? Overweight? Is this guy crazy? Give me the phone. I'll tell him what overweight is. Cosmetic surgery? This guy is a loon. How could you just sit there and take that? What do you mean sailing is boring? You love sailing. Didn't you tell him to go walk off a pier and then see if he would like to see you come sailing by? He pushed you for sex after you told him how important it was for you to wait? This guy is really selfish." They were mad. And at first, Debbie was somewhat defensive of Nick, telling them how nice he was and how he would never be mean or mistreat her. But they were relentless and would not allow her denial to continue. He was nice, but he was kidnapping her. She was being separated from her friends, support systems, and everything that was important to her, even her values. Slowly, she began to get it. And she did what she should have done earlier. She used her support network to ground her, and from that position of strength, she began to get stronger and more direct with Nick. She returned to her strong stand on the limits of their physical relationship, and she said that it was important that he do some things with her friends as well as go sailing with her. Nick was not defensive. He said that he did not realize that he was hurting her feelings by his comments and actions. He said he was sorry. They decided to go forward from there. It looked good for a little while, but reality began to set in again as to his real nature and intentions, conscious or not. He was still bothered by her appearance, wanting her to change. He resentfully went to things she suggested, but it was not a joyful participation. There was new conflict. But this time there was a huge element that made all the difference in the world. Debbie stayed connected to her friends and community. She spent time with them, as well as Nick, and she went back to church and her activities. In her interactions with her friends, she could describe what was happening, and they were able to give her feedback. They were able to help her see the reality of this relationship. And finally, she and Nick broke up. Sound like a good ending? You bet it is. Debbie was spared much heartache that would have been certain if she had gone forward. Without the support of her friends, her need for a relationship just might have driven her to continue, even into marriage with Nick. Friends gave her several important ingredients that every dating relationship must have in order to be based in reality. Let's look at those ingredients here. A feedback base to see reality. Being in love in the beginning of a relationship is an illness. It is treatable, but it is an illness nevertheless. The illness is the inability to see reality. For the very state of being in love is a state of idealization, where the other person is not really viewed through the eyes of reality. He or she is mostly seen through the eyes of someone's own wishes or fantasies that the other person is able to symbolize. But often the fantasies are based on enough reality that the stage of idealization can move to something real and lasting. The problem is that if the idealizations are strong enough, and the person's need for them to be true are strong enough, then he or she can omit large chunks of reality about the person he's in love with. This is why staying connected to a group of friends who know you well is so important. Your friends and often family can see things about your new love that you will not be able to see. And you should trust them. Unless there is something wrong in your relationships with them, or they are particularly dysfunctional, they will not be looking through the eyes of idealization and need and will see the person more clearly. Have you ever wondered how some people that you know and love were able to pick the difficult or sometimes awful person that they're with? Do you think that the prince just one day turned into a frog? Most times not. The frog was always a frog, even if he was dressed up like a prince in courtship. But the princess was looking through the eyes of idealization or denial. Borrow your friend's vision. You might need it. Also, they know you, and they know what's important to you. They can see if you're becoming a more well-rounded, complete you with this person, or if you're becoming someone other than yourself. They know who you are, and will be able to see if you're growing into more of who God created you to be. These two things were drastically missing in Debbie's relationship with Nick. Because they did not do things with her friends and family, and because she was not staying close to her friends, she could not see the two realities that were occurring, her idealization of a controlling person and her becoming someone other than who she really was. Her friends could have told her that along the way if she had stayed connected to them. A support base to deal with reality. We don't deal with reality for two reasons. Either we do not see it, or we see it and are unable or unwilling to deal with it. Many times we will know that there is something wrong in a relationship, and that we need better or different boundaries. Sometimes we even know that the relationship is stupid or sinful, but we cannot find it in ourselves to break away or do the right thing. That's where the power of a support system is needed. As Ecclesiastes 4:9-12 says, two are better than one, because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. In part, we find the strength to do what we cannot do from the people who support us. They stand by us in difficult times to do several things. Give us emotional support. Give us truth and wisdom. Give us courage to take strong stands on values or morals. Give us courage to take strong stands with hurtful people. Give us comfort and strength to let go and grieve difficult situations or people. Give us knowledge and skills that we do not possess. In Debbie's situation, she would have never been able to take the stand that she needed to take with Nick if her friends had not been there to support her. She was afraid of the conflict in the beginning, and they gave her the strength to stand up and face it. Then, when it got worse, without them, she probably would have caved in to Nick because she loved him or needed him so much. And finally, when she saw that this was a relationship that she did not want to go further in and she needed to break up, her friends helped her through the grief. So many times, because of loneliness and abandonment feelings, a person will go through a breakup that is needed and then go right back into the relationship to do it all over again. Friends and support systems provide the support you need to go through with a breakup. As Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 3:6, there is a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to throw away. Some dating relationships need to end and the time has come, but the person is not strong enough to do what is needed. Friends and community can be a lifesaver in that situation. Connection to all the parts of her. As Debbie was dating Nick, she was losing parts of herself. That's not what happens in a good relationship. A good relationship helps us to become more of who God made us to be, not less. Slowly, Debbie was losing touch with not only her friends, but herself as well. She lost touch with her love of service and volunteer work. She lost touch with her passion for sailing and for art. She lost touch with her feelings for and drive to be close to God. In addition, she was losing other aspects of herself. She generally was becoming a less well-rounded person and more one-dimensional. Her deeper spirituality had almost dried up completely, as well as her full range of emotional responsiveness. Because she was losing touch with her life, she lost her ability to feel a lot of life's passions and emotions. Her anger and her sense of protest had given way to dullness. Nick was all there was, and as a result, there was a lot less of Debbie. Her friends noticed this. They took her out to movies and museums. They listened to music and went to art shows with her. She took them sailing, and she returned to her singles group at church, where she enjoyed many people and activities. Slowly, she was becoming herself again. If she had been involved with her friends all along, she would have not lost these parts of herself and would have found out earlier the problems with Nick. She would have stayed connected to all of who she was, and he would have had to be able to relate to her or at least not keep her from doing the things that she loved. If you're continuing to do life as you were before you started dating, you remain yourself, and the two of you get to know all of who each other is. Friends help you do that. They help you stay connected to the things you were connected with before you started dating. The other side of this is that friends notice personality changes, for the better or the worse. How many times have you heard someone say, "Oh, she's grown so much since she started dating so-and-so. He just brings out the best in her." It's a beautiful thing, and your friends will be able to see that. And how many times have you heard, "She's changed so much since she started dating so-and-so. She's not herself. I don't even like to be around her anymore." Sometimes a dating relationship can change someone for the worse, too. Relationships have that kind of power when someone does not have good boundaries. It's up to friends to help give you that feedback if it's happening. It may be difficult to hear, but remember, wounds from a friend can be trusted. Proverbs 27, verse 6a. Sometimes we need to hear what our friends have to say about things that we cannot see. grounding in spiritual values that make life work. Our spiritual values and our relationship with God ground us and make life work. He designed things that way. Our values are the architecture of life. They shape the way our life is going to be. If we value things like honesty, purity, compassion, sobriety, kindness, responsibility, and on, life will take on a certain shape that has a good end. However, when we begin to let our values slip, our life takes a different direction that does not have a good end. When Debbie began sleeping with Nick, she had lost a value that was very important to her, and which also protected her from losing other aspects of herself. The pseudo-intimacy that they were having in sex was blinding her from seeing the lack of real intimacy in the relationship. That is one way that purity protects single people. When she began to adapt to his perfectionistic physical demands on her looks and appearance, she lost touch with her honesty and value for kindness. What he was doing was not kind, and she should have honestly told him that she valued kindness in a relationship. His criticizing her physical appearance when she was